Welcome to Cycle Systems Academy podcast. As promised, we've got Matt Clark from Plush Suspension back on the podcast. Welcome back, Matt.
Hello, Sean. How are you doing?
Yeah, we're all doing good. And it's been a couple of years since we spoke to you on the podcast. So I guess before we get all really techie and into suspension and forks, what's been happening at Plush Suspension?
Yeah, it's been a little while. I think we've been trying to get this podcast done for a little while now. So my apologies for being so elusive and then having a baby and then being ill and all those things. But in the midst of doing all of that, Plush has been kind of going from strength to strength, I guess. We've done all sorts of stuff. We've got more people. We've got a different space now. We've got a much bigger workshop. Some other brands have come on board. We've become the specialized UK service and warranty center for specialized in the UK. So that was quite a big one for us. Mm-hmm. We've just recently become the Push service center as well, the only one in the UK. So we're starting to tick off a few milestones that we wanted. Push being one of those, actually. But it's just been very, very busy and riding our bikes and fixing stuff and tuning things, and there's more to come. We're still scratching the surface, of course, but as you always are with a business, you know. But it's good.
Cool. And we've talked about staffing in the past, and you know, probably a dream job for me would be to work for you for a year and learn. I don't think that'll ever happen just with the way of the world as it is. But I remember we spoke a while back and you were recruiting, and it staggered me that you were actually struggling to recruit people. So have you found the people that you need, and is it easier or harder or the same to recruit at the moment?
I think Plush is quite unique because we're not going to get a suspension technician unless we directly approach someone at another service centre, which we just wouldn't do. So you kind of have to put the advert out, see who's interested, and just see if they've got any underlying skills that you think will lend themselves well to suspension tuning and servicing. So things like being very methodical and happy to follow instruction and that kind of thing is what we look for. So I think we've done pretty well with Plush, actually. We've been very, very lucky with the staff that I've brought on board. And now I've got Adam essentially managing the team there, and he's bringing everything on. And we've got Gabe dealing with all the tech side of things, and he's really getting his teeth into stuff, and he's got an amazing ability to simplify real tech stuff. So we've got five people now, plus the rest of the team and the other business. But in total with the bike shop and Brink is 22 people now. So there's a really big team.
Mm-hmm.
I just think I've been really lucky with the staff that we've got, and especially in Plush. You know, those guys, they absolutely smash it. They're all really passionate about bikes. They all race, they all ride. We just actually employed a guy called Mason who got an honours degree from Oxford, actually, in engineering. So he's been really interesting to have on board as a suspension technician. He just loves bikes, so he's massively overqualified. But the take that he has on things, and kind of the out and out kind of authority he has over whether something is or isn't right, is really, really good. Because he'll just say, well, no, because here's the maths, and that's why that doesn't work that way. And then he stops a lot of arguments in the workshop, that's for sure. Because you can't really argue with him, because he goes, well, no, it's this force curve and that's this and blah blah blah, and then you go, oh, okay. So we found the right people, but not for trying. It's I wouldn't say it's got any easier. I think training is a big part of it as well. We do try and train people as best we can, obviously with my background being in training and stuff, but to be honest, the boys do all the training now. I'm very much backseat with that sort of stuff. But no, the team is brilliant. I love them all.
Good. And if I remember rightly, because obviously you guys did some webinar lessons for our members in the kind of early beta stages of it. And I think it was Gabe that did, was it a DVO bleed that included a fish tank?
Yes. Yeah, the fish tank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still got your fish tank for a rear damper.
Probably, yeah. It's probably a little bit less fish tankish now. I think we've pretty much figured out adapters now. The problem is you can't get hold of certain adapters for bleed screws and things like that, so you have to just submerge them. In a low pressure damper, that's fine. If it's high pressure, you need to put it on a machine. But it's when you're trying to teach people how to do suspension, then you turn around and say, right now. Clear out your fish tank for the next the next hour and fill it full of 10 weight, and we'll bleed some dampers. But yeah, Gabe did a real good job, I think, of those videos. They can be quite nerve wracking as well, I think, if you're not a teacher, you're not experienced in it. So those guys are keen for more stuff like that, actually.
Great stuff. Well, maybe we'll speak to you about that in the future. Yeah. So. What I wanted to do, of course, is get really into the tech side of it. There'll be lots of people listening who've done their level 3 with us at Cycle Systems, and they service some nice RockShox droppers and rear shocks and forks and want to learn more. But when we spoke about doing this podcast, you said you were really passionate to talk about setup, because so many people get the setup wrong or aren't even aware that setup can be something that you get wrong. And it is fundamental, isn't it? So do you want to take us through basics of fork and shock setup, what people can get wrong, what people need to be aware of, and then maybe look at some products to say, well, look, if you just want to buy a bike and ride it with minimal setup, this is what you're looking for. If you're a tinkerer, this is what you're looking for.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's part of the business now for Plush that is essentially it's going to be our focus going forward. Setup solutions and setup services is going to be something that is going to be front and center for Plush going forward. Probably more so than service, I would say. Throughout the years of doing this and helping people with suspension, after servicing, it's the one biggest change that you can make to the bike that just transforms the performance of the bike straight away, pretty much. And it's there for you to use as well. You know, you're not fitting an upgrade, you're not having to spend lots of money on something. It's just having the dials, your air pressure or your coil spring correct for your weight and riding style, really. And there's lots of misnomers, and you can get pretty caught up in, you can get quite lost in adjusters, and you can get quite lost in people's opinions, and you can read lots of things online. And what we'd really like to do with Plush, and what I would like to do, is try and simplify that for people and take it out of the sort of black magic side of things into a bit more of a product, basically, something that we can get people on board with, something we can set people up with and they're happy with. And we have been doing that with our setup, but everybody needs a setup. Pretty much. I haven't felt a single bike that couldn't do with something. Even people that have got a high level of understanding sometimes have got themselves lost down a path because they read something on a forum or they watched a video and that's the direction they went with their setup. And then they may be riding around issues that their setup has caused, but because in their mind, the placebo effect said, oh, no, I read that article, so I have to have all my rebound all the way on or whatever. You know what I mean? So, setup's fascinating because it's half technical and half psychological. And I really enjoy that kind of to and fro process between a rider and a setup. And it helps with setup, especially if the person that's doing the setup is a very competent rider. If you understand how a bike reacts in lots of different situations, so if you've raced, if you've done a lot of riding, if you can ride at pace, it really helps you when you feel someone else's bike. You can bounce on it, jump up and down on it, and you kind of know straight away this isn't going to work, but for these reasons. And essentially there's two setups. There's opinion setup, and then there's assisted setup. And what I mean by that is the opinion setup would be me, my experience, setting your bike up for you based on the things that you tell me. So you could say, I ride Peak District all the time, and I'm definitely 75 kilos, which always has a plus minus tolerance on it, if I'm honest, when we're doing setup. And then I will set you up based on where you ride and your rider weight. Now, assisted setup is a little bit more techy, because we need instruments and we need measurements. So we start getting into telemetry, we need potentiometers, and we run you on the hill and we get data, and then we interpret the data more than possibly what the rider is saying. But that needs to be taken with a pinch of salt as well, of course. So what I'm saying is basically there's two different ways of setting a bike up. Most people are going to be able to do the opinion one. We actually sell that as a service at Plush. You can come in, get your bike set up by us. And then pretty much 99% of people go away feeling like the bike is completely transformed. So, I can run through what we do in that if you wanted. I can kind of go through my...
Well, I would say that's helpful, and it's really fascinating listening to this, because the first time when you came on the podcast and talked about this, we added this into our suspension lessons. Okay. So previous to that, we'd had a theory lecture, and I think you even did some, didn't you, at Cycle Systems when we were up in London, and you'd tell people about suspension and how it works, what's a spring, what's a damper, and then they strip some forks and put them back together and they write some questions. But when you described the setup to me, I realized that, God, yeah, some of these guys have never ridden a mountain bike.
Yeah.
So we need to take them out the back of the academy, find a whole set of stairs, and we need to session the stairs with the dampers on full fast, session the stairs on the dampers on full low, film them on an iPad on slow-mo, ask them how it felt and show them how it looks. And then, of course, we get to perfect setup. And it's really brought that suspension lesson alive, I believe. So I'm fascinated to hear what you're doing with it now.
Well, that's definitely... So a term that we throw around at work a little bit is feel knowledge. And that feel knowledge is something that comes from some, some real basic kind of, suspension setup theories called bracketing. And bracketing essentially is where the extreme of bracketing would be that you ride your bike with all your adjusters, completely unwound, so open. And then you ride the same bit of trail again with all your adjusters fully closed. And then you've got this feel knowledge of the same trail with all your adjusters open and all your adjusters closed. And you get to understand what effect those settings have on the dynamics of the bike on the same piece of trail. The bracketing kind of idea comes in that you then go from fully open or from fully closed, and get closer and closer and closer towards a setting that is correct. So you bring those brackets in towards wherever you feel comfortable, basically, on the bike. So that's something you can do on the trail, either by running it open first and then fully closed, or fully closed first and then going back towards open on your clickers. And that'll get you to a good position. So, but in store, we can't do that. We don't have a trail. So we basically use a lot of manufacturers' recommended settings, to be honest. And a lot of the time, even finding those can be a bit of a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Some manufacturers don't have those that easy to find. So we've dug a lot of that stuff out. We've got a lot of spreadsheets that we've used and taken data on, and then we compare settings, and we've got our own database bank, basically, that we can use, plus our experience. And I would say, out of all of this, our experience as suspension technicians and our experience as riders really does shine above any recommended setting from manufacturers, purely because it's circumstantial. So the bike's in front of you, and certain things make a big difference to a suspension setup. So things like stem length, for instance. If someone's got a really short stem, it's going to put their weight further back. You're going to have an imbalance of sag if you've got a really short stem. So the manufacturer, the recommended settings for the manufacturer don't take that into account. Mm. Whereas we do. We also take into account tire pressure, whether the bike size is right for you. All that stuff adds up to basically a whole setup package that we offer. And if you want, I can basically go through exactly what we do in that setup.
I'm sure there isn't an average rider, but let's assume, you know, someone rocks up and, you know, they've probably got a very expensive bike that's performing very badly. And if anyone listening isn't aware, that isn't just a bit of a crap riding experience. It can be incredibly dangerous. You know, if your dampers are set too slow, the rebound damper especially, the bike can just pack down and you're over the bars.
Yeah.
And if the rebound dampers are too fast, it's going to pogo and throw you off the bike. So these are quite serious, aren't they? It's not just about downhill racers going half a second faster. It's about everybody riding safer.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do come across that quite a lot, where people say things like, "Oh, I'm not fast enough to. I don't need a setup. I don't need all that. So I just get on the bike and ride it." And it's like, well, you could ride it a hell of a lot better if you just. Just came to us for a setter, and you'd have a better time, and your bike would feel how it is supposed to feel. The manufacturer specs that leverage rate or whatever, so that it felt good, but it still needs setting up. And like I say, we do see that a lot. People that have spent lots and lots of money on a bike, or even worse, lots and lots of money upgrading their suspension, and then not setting it up because they just wanted Kashima stanchion. And it's like, well, you could have kept your old suspension and just put your high speed rebound in the right place, and you would have gone loads quicker. And it's not always about being quick either. It's about having fun on the bike. You know, when your suspension's set up, the bike is just a joy. They're so much nicer to ride, and you don't get arm pumped, and you're in control, and things feel fun, and it's just. Anyone will enjoy that, you know. And actually, yes, when you talk about a racer's setup, that's where things start to get different. And that's where things are a different conversation to what we're talking about now.
Cool. Well, take us through then the average rider's setup and process in a racer's.
Yeah, sure. So what we would normally do. So your average rider would come in, and we'd firstly look at the bike and just kind of ascertain whether there's anything that is glaringly obvious. So if they're 6'5" and they've got a small bike, then a small frame bike, then there's going to be certain things that we can't get around in terms of what they expect from our setup experience, if you like. If they say, "Oh, I keep going over the handlebars," it's like, well, you're 6'5" and you're on a small bike, so that's going to happen. So we try and have kind of a quick conversation with the customer about what it is they want to achieve from their setup with us, basically. And then we'd record all the settings. So we record all the air pressures, or we record the core spring rate. We count all the clickers, so we know exactly where the customer's setup was before we start making any changes. We record that down, so we've got a data input sheet that we put those clickers into. Because we don't want to make some changes that maybe someone didn't like without giving them the ability to go back to their original setting. So we do that first. And then essentially what we do is open all the adjusters. So that's everything fully counterclockwise. So we open everything up. So it's all on its fastest, essentially. But the reason we do that is because we want to set sag without there being any kind of restriction from the damper in the system. So we would set sag, check the customer's sag levels, check the air pressure levels. And then based on that sag level, we would then move on to the damper. Now, before we get into dampers, you've obviously got coil springs and air springs, and we would change those over dependent on where, how we measured the sag. We've measured the sag based on what the customer, again, what they want to achieve. So if they're riding somewhere super, super, super bumpy and rocky, we might go for a little bit more sag in the bike. So we might look at 30%, 33%, 35% sag, something like that. Because you want those wheels to track and move around on bumps and things. Whereas if they're riding around here, like what kind of Woburn area where it's quite jumpy, bike park, not that bumpy, you might go for a bit of a stiffer setup. This is for your average rider. So we basically get that dialed in first without any damper settings. And then whilst we're looking at sag and air pressure, we start to ask questions about ramp. Now, when we start talking about ramp with customers, generally they sort of gloss over. And for me, ramp or progressiveness, inherent progressiveness in inverted commas, in terms of the feel of the suspension is such an important feature of the air spring, especially, irrespective of damping characteristics. But you've got to get it right. And again, that's based on the conversation with the customer. So, if they're riding somewhere very, very steep, for instance, we might put a little bit more ramp into the fork because their weight is going to be committed more to the front wheel, the front of the bike.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that by fitting volume spacing. Depending on which brand it is, there's various different ways of adjusting air spring volume, essentially positive air volume. And we would kind of spec that based on what we feel after the customer's told us where they ride, basically. If they're riding somewhere super, super rocky again, we might back that down a bit. If we might run a little bit less ramp, so the fork or the shock's a bit more linear. And what that'll do is that'll allow the wheel to track a little bit more. It won't be as good on jumps, but it will absorb the bumps better. And there's always a trade-off between those two things. You can have a bike that is poppy and playful, or you can have a bike that absorbs bumps. You generally can't have both. So that's how we would set ramp, essentially.
Sure. So the spring rate, the positive spring rate.
Yeah, exactly. That's mostly on fork. When it comes to the rear shock, it really depends on the leverage rate of the bike. And if it's a good manufacturer with quality design, they would have had a leverage rate in the bike that promotes the shock flowing down towards the end of the travel anyway. So there'll be ramp engineered into the leverage of the bike at the rear of the bike, basically. And that's where you start getting into conversations where some bikes don't work for coil shocks, for instance. There's quite a lot of bikes out there that have a very linear rate. So that is the amount of linkage that's pushed throughout the travel stays the same. So the amount of the speed the linkage moves throughout the travel compared to the rear wheel stays the same. Those bikes inherently don't work very well with a coil because a coil is completely linear. And you just end up with a bike that runs through its travel and bottoms out. So things like specialized, lots of specialized bikes, not so much this year or the year before, but anything pre-2019 is very, very linear. And they did that because it's an American brand based in a very bumpy place. and they wanted a bike with a linea that tracked well over rocks. So if you try and put a core spring on one of those, they can have some. You can fit them. I'm not saying you can't fit them. It's just they have some characteristics that aren't advantageous really to performance anyway.
And it is true, is it, that some frames will be digressive, some frames will be linear, and some frames will be progressive. And then, of course, you need a shock that's going to work with that and complement that. And I think that comes back to something you said earlier, that if people just see a video or an article online and which says coil shocks are cool, which is something we've seen, and they go, oh, I'm going to put that on my bike, you could ruin the whole performance of your bike. So I think you're highlighting, aren't you, the importance of the setup. So what else is going on for the average rider then, Matt? And then what's happening with the races?
So, I mean, once you've set SAG, you then move on to setting the dampers, basically. And that's where I would say a lot of the differences between a normal rider and a racer is that I'd like to think, well, ideally, some racers come with an idea of what these clickers do. some maybe not, but I mean, we've got a race team and we've had tech evenings with them, and you know, even those guys that are all, some of those are national champions on our team, and they even some of them are like, I don't know, I just set it in the middle and ride it, and it's kind of like, well, you can do that, but if you set it up, it's free. It's free speed. It's free advantage. And what we normally say to our average riders is we do explain the clickers. So we go through them. We explain what high speed is compared to low speed. And we kind of give them a well-rounded idea of what those clickers do. And then we'd simply set the bike up based on our experience, write the clickers down, and hand the bike back to the customer. With the experienced racers or anyone that's racing, we'd then go into a little bit more detail about how those clickers can be used as tools to increase their speed, basically based on the track that they're riding. Because a lot of your damper settings are basically track specific, not rider weight specific, which is a common misconception. The other common misconception is that there is a correct damper setting for you. Again, which there isn't. It's all track specific. And probably compression is the most track specific, with rebound being probably more sensitive to air pressure in the fork, basically. So that's more to do with ride away. So that's the difference is with your average rider, we would set the bike up, suggest settings, and then hand the bike to them, explain the clickers a little bit. But with racers, we would talk to them about the chassis stability, holding the front end up with low speed compression. We'd talk about trying to get away with as fast rebound as we possibly can. We talk about the shocks getting hot on long descents versus cool. We talk about promoting grip on the tire using low speed. We talk about bringing clickers on as you learn a track. All these things get really, really nuanced and quite complex, but there is some logic to it, basically.
And for any mechanics listening, you know, if you've been inspired by the mechanic reg videos that we did about being a race mechanic, this is really, really essential skills, isn't it, for mountain bike race mechanics?
Yeah, very much so. And this is where like the whole package comes into play. So you can be a great mechanic, but you need to understand the dynamics of the mountain bike if you're going to suggest settings or make changes to a pro's bike at a high level. You need to be able to ride really fast and understand what that means. Sure, you're not going to be able to ride like Greg Minnaar, but certainly I'm pretty sure, you know, I'm pretty sure Greg's mechanic is pretty handy on a bike as well. I can tell you that for sure. So you need, again, I talk about that feel knowledge, and that is more extreme version of that, really, is that you understand the demands that a World Cup track will put on a bike. After that, it's very much to and fro with the rider, really, and just if they're telling you that they're getting arm pump or it's chattering or something like that, you can start to use your knowledge to go, okay, it's chattering, maybe let's look at the settings. Oh, there's too much high speed rebound, so it's packing down, which makes it feel chattery, which gives you arm pump. So it could be something that you're not expecting as well, because a rider could say, feels really chattery on the front of the bike, I'm getting arm pump, but their compression is really, really low on the clicks. So you're not running, it's not compression that's causing the problem. The sag setting is correct for their weight, so it's not that. So the next thing is to look at rebound. Is it packing down?
Okay.
So there is a structure to these things, and there is a way of kind of getting your head around what the rider is telling you. The problem is what the rider is telling you, and that's the hardest bit. You look at those videos of Jordy talking to Loris Vergier, and it's like, I don't know how he does it. Loris is on another planet when he's trying to describe actually what his bike's doing, and it's Jordy's job to then translate that into, oh, you need two less clicks of low speed compression.
Oh, well, we'll have to get the links to those for the show notes, Matt. So
I'll find you one, the look on Geordie's face is the best when he's when Loris is trying to describe things. So
that is
the hardest bit, I'd say.
Of course,
being a suspension technician is setting something up, is interpreting someone else's feel on the bike into setting.
Yeah, exactly. It's a suspension setting version of my bike's making a click. Can you make it stop?
Exactly. Yeah.
So essentially for consumers then, there's a massive range of suspension out there now. Obviously, a lot of people are simply riding the suspension that's on their bike. And some people are just going, oh, shiny things. And I remember you saying once that Olin suspension, while it was fantastically good as its reputation is, I think you said you hadn't sold a single item of Olin suspension that didn't need a complete damper tune for the rider. Was that right? That was the case?
Probably at the time.
Okay.
Things have moved on a little bit with Olin's now. Everything's a little bit. They were learning, basically.
Okay. Very essentially, but obviously,
or background, everything was very, very overdamped.
Okay. But obviously, the different brands are going to have different strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, it used to be said that one brand was probably better overall, but needed more servicing, and this brand maybe wasn't as good, but it was more just ride it and service it less. Do you think those gaps are changing? Because it's an incredibly competitive market now, isn't it? And people like push and such out there. So if someone was saying to you, you know, asking for advice about suspension, would you say that service, understanding, setup, and then tuning is more important than a particular brand? Or are there certain brands that are going to suit certain riders and certain bikes?
Yeah, I would agree with your first statement, really. I think the brand of suspension that you have now doesn't matter as much, really. A lot of the technologies are getting closer and closer and closer to each other. A lot of manufacturers are using twin tube now. A lot of them are using high volume negative air, adjustable positive air volume. They're all super stiff. Like, there's not much between them, really. Whereas if you service them properly, get them set up properly, and buy the right type of suspension for your bike, that's something that's really important to understand. Is if you've got an aluminium e-bike, you need a 38 mil fork.
Mm-hmm.
Don't buy a 36 mil fork. You could buy the poshest 36 mil fork in the world with all the bells and whistles. It won't be as good as a mid-level 38 mil fork purely because it's stiffer and it doesn't flex and the bushes don't bind. So there's lots of, especially with e-bike now, there's lots of e-bike specific things, and they're e-bike specific for a really good reason, and the reason is stiffness. With the suspension fork especially, the stiffness of the fork has a direct result on vibration getting to your hands, and that's the whole point of suspension, is that the vibration doesn't get to your hand. So the stiffer the fork can be, the more compliant the fork can be, the less forces go through the fork in the wrong way, the better the bike will feel, basically. And a lot of e-bikes are coming with 38 mil forks now. If it's a super light e-bike, so one of those like the Orbea Rise or the
bloody awful things. I rode some of those. I rode some at the Verbier e-bike festival this summer. They were fucking shit, man. You know, just give me if it's an e-bike, give me a beast.
Yeah, they are weird. Like, I'm not sure. So I've got a big full fat e-bike now.
Yeah, cool. It's
flipping amazing.
Yeah.
And there's like, you've got Kinevo SL, Levo SL, there's all these sort of lightweight ones.
Mm.
I'm still yet to figure out what they're for, really.
I think you can throw them around a bit more. I mean, I rode with some of the Specialized pros on that. I couldn't keep up with them after the first jump, as you might imagine. Right. But they were throwing these bikes around like they would an acoustic bike.
Yeah.
And that's why they loved them. Right? And I get that. But I'm a middle-aged guy who likes to ride off-road to get into nature, you know. So for me, it's just give me a big-ass motor and battery to get up the hill. But sorry, Matt, you were saying in terms of the technical side.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's I think that's most of performance gains can be found in setup than having a high speed, low speed damper or Kashima coated legs. the percentage difference that you'll feel in the bike from hard anodized black to Kashima coating is minute amounts, really, compared to setup. Setup will make your average customer, I'd say, their bike comes away from us 30 to 35% better.
It is staggering, isn't it? That's really staggering, the amount of difference it makes. And like I said, it's not just performance, it's safety as well. I think it's worth qualifying that we're talking about mid to high end suspension forks, aren't we, here? So what that translates as, that, you know, if you've got a mountain bike, and maybe you could, you know, be better with the price points, but I say if you've got a mountain bike that's kind of 500 to 1200 pounds, you know, work that out in your own currency, the suspension fork on there is going to be absolutely entry level. And again, anyone that's been to one of our courses or competitors' courses, your first day on suspension, you're pulling apart these absolutely entry level forks. And you can see, even servicing them, how terrible they are.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of servicing you're going to get done on a RockShox XC30 setup that you're going to do, essentially. So we're talking about the mid-end to high-end where you can really make a difference. So
A fork with a rudimentary compression damper on the top, your blue dial, and then a rebound dial at the bottom, adjustable volume, and then probably air spring. Those sort of four things are the go-to basics to get you set up really, really well. If you can find a fork or shock with those features, you'll be fine, basically.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognised cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports, and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.
Next week's podcast, which funnily enough I recorded this morning as we speak, is with Mark Haylett from Bosch. He's the senior trainer for Bosch mechanics in the UK and for dealers. And he was talking about, you know, you can't just go and buy a Bosch motor. You know, they sell OEM to bike manufacturers, and the bike manufacturers release the bike with the Bosch motor.
Yeah.
So in terms of a full suspension mountain bike, everything in that bike is being designed in conjunction with that motor and the way it all works in terms of the torque and the power and the weight and the position. And the suspension's a fairly key part of that. So if you come across e-mountain bikers who've maybe swapped forks and shocks around and they've had quite unfortunate experiences.
Yeah, I have, unfortunately. Mostly with rear shock issues.
Yeah.
And mostly on bikes that weren't designed to take a coil. Like you were talking about just now, you know, coil shock, that's the best thing. I need a coil shock. Well, yeah, you do, but you can't have one on your bike, and we can figure something out, and there are aftermarket fixes like cascade links you can buy for various bikes. I've got a cascade link on one of my Santa Cruzes, and it changes the leverage rate of the bike and allows you to run a coil, so it will, instead of the bike having 19% progressivity, it would go up to above 30 or something, which will allow you to then run a coil sensibly. So we do have that a lot. And the other thing that we find with e-bikers and with coil shock again is that we sometimes, if you're over the 100 kilo mark, maybe 110 kilos, we're off the chart for coil spring. There isn't a coil spring for you.
Yeah.
So I can't make it any firmer. And those conversations are actually the hardest.
I'm sure.
Because we've had a few customers where they've been maybe not super happy. And I've said to them, look, you're going to have to be really honest with me. How much do you weigh?
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some scales. I try not to get them out. I try to trust what people say. But every now and again, you run into a bit of a customer service issue, and it's just someone lying to you about how much they weigh. and they're 130 kilos, not 98.
Yep.
And that's a massive difference, because it means the coil shock that you bought doesn't work on your bike. And you have to go small volume air can, which is what you had on it before, which is what Specialized spec on it, because they knew that their state was poor for a coil, which is why they spec a small air can air shock. So we do have that a lot. We have people that have bought shocks, even bought shocks from us, and it hasn't quite met their expectation on the e-bike. So, and I think that's where you don't really see that many off-the-shelf coil sprung e-bikes.
Yeah.
And I think also that the way that the weight interacts with the suspension systems or the linkage makes having a linear suspension system on an e-bike possibly advantageous for grip.
Mm-hmm.
So when you actually load the bike up, it squats in its travel, just like kind of motocross bike does. You can imagine in the wet. You want that bike to squat because it's going to promote grip on an off-camber, slightly uphill, rooty bit, for instance. So there's lots of design kind of theory that comes into it from manufacturers, and especially with e-bike being so new, I think a lot of manufacturers were finding their feet with leverage rate of e-bikes. And like you say, there's the odd YouTube video out there that says, oh, get a coil shock, it's the best thing ever. There are solutions out there, like I say, but they're few and far between. But cascade link is definitely one of them. If you're a heavy rider, you can't really run one because it actually increases the leverage overall. It just changes the difference between the starting leverage and the ending leverage. But things like the Storia shock or the Push 11.6 have both got hydraulic bottom out. actually in the damper. So that really helps with a bike that's got a linear leverage rate. It's a hydraulic support mechanism, basically, to stop the bike from running through its travel. Mm-hmm. So those things, there are solutions out there, but they might not be, you might have to sit down when I tell you the price of them, you know. they're expensive solutions, but if you want a core shock for your specialized, your 2018 Levo, then you need to buy a push shock, and it's 1400 quid. There have been some instances we've had with e-bikes and that added weight and what that means for the suspension setup. We've also had some fork issues, especially with bushes on longer travel bikes. They're a perishable item, and e-bikes push bushes more, especially slack bikes. People run them around flat areas, you know. If you've got 63-degree head angle, 170mm travel fork, but you're riding it around Surrey Hills, it's pretty flat. It's not that steep, and you're putting more load vertically through the fork than you should be.
Yeah.
And then you've got a heavy aluminium e-bike. Maybe you've got a backpack on because you're going out all day. You've got a big, powerful 220mm rotor on there. You're going to destroy your bushes. So we have that quite a lot. E-bikes eating bushes. maybe that's where, like I say, that's where 38mm starts to come into its own.
Yeah, certainly. And definitely, if you go to sram.com/rockshocks, there's absolutely loads on there about the e-bike specific forks. And in fact, some of the models of forks are so beefy and so stiff that they're suitable for acoustic handle e-bikes. But there's lots and lots of e-bike specific stuff as well. So talking of batteries on bikes, and there was some sort of jokey Twitter post yesterday, which got a lot of engagement, just how many batteries do you need on your mountain bike?
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
There's April, because of course, if you've got an e-bike, it's great. You can run everything off the one battery, as you'll find out next week with Mark Haylett. But essentially what we're seeing now with access technology is, of course, it can be applied to the suspension system as well. And just a word on the Access mountain bike group sets, because I first got to ride them at the Verbier e-bike festival, and it was really interesting. Got to ride a whole bunch of different bikes and the most amazing trails, both up and down. And in terms of actually riding and pressing the shifter and the chain moving, there isn't a discernible difference between a Dior shifter with a gear cable and the Access. You know, it doesn't feel any different to the rider. It's not a fast, because it's wireless, it's not fast like Shimano DI2. You know, if you're on a road bike, DI2 is a complete game changer. Yeah. So basically, with Access, it's like, it's very expensive, it's awesome for the mechanics. Like, we love these wireless group sets as mechanics. But of course, with with suspension, it's not just about making a control wireless, well, it is for the dropper post, but it's actually creating a control system. So what Specialized have done is they've got the flight attendant, which has got a whole suite of sensors for the rider, for the terrain, and that means they say that it can dial in the perfect setup. Because as you say, so much of it is trail specific. So the idea is it changes depending on how much torque you're putting in, depending on if you're somewhere bumpy or flat. So it sounds incredible in many ways, and obviously there may be downsides. One of the potential downsides I'm seeing is there's lots of sticky outy bits, and I'd be a bit concerned about crashing and breaking them. But have you seen this in the flesh yet? Have you been looking into it? What are the noises being made?
Yeah, I did read into it a lot, actually. I also listened to Vital had a podcast on it from a guy, one of the designers of the flight attendant, actually. That's worth listening to.
Okay, we'll get the link out, yep.
It's really, really interesting, and it's the biggest thing for me with flight attendant is that they've got this cadence sensor in the crane. That's the game changer. Lots of people have done electronic suspension all the way back to, I'm trying to remember who it was. Was it ProFlex that had a laser based lockout system that measured the distance to the front wheel with a laser, basically, and it could sense how fast the wheel was moving, basically. So this stuff's been around for a long time, but what RockShox have done, which is a bit of a game changer in my eyes, is give the suspension a rider induced data point, which is pedaling. Are they on the pedals? Is there torque in the bike? Are they actually stood up? Are they sat down? I'm sure they can figure all this stuff out from that cadence, which changes a lot of things. And I know at the moment it's kind of first iteration, and it does at the moment is sort of manages the pedal induced forces into the bike, but it does that everywhere. So it does that out of a berm on a downhill. So you put a big pedal in, and it firms things up, and it's there at the moment. But where could it go? You know, could you have it so that it senses and understands how much sag there is at any point on the front and rear? So then you know the rider's weight bias in your bike. So then you can start changing damper settings if you know the weight bias. So if it feels like there's 80% sag on the front and none on the back, then it knows you're going over the bars. So it speeds the rebound up and firms the compression up. And that'll save you. That'll stop you going over the bars, basically.
Yeah. Sunday save.
So it will get there, but it would need to be, on the piston. So that would actually need to be changeable damper piston, so it wouldn't necessarily be an adjuster buzzing in and out. It would need to actually be inside the fork, but that's where it's going, and that's what's really exciting is the automated kind of optimized bump compliance for that particular bump. That's the exciting bit, is that the bump before this bump it optimized for, and the bump after this bump it'll optimize for. And if you're halfway through the travel because you're in a berm and there's bumps in the berm, it'll optimize for both those things. So that's the exciting bit, is just how fast could, like a World Cup downhiller, for instance, just how fast could you go on a bike if you had that? Because at the moment you've got manual settings. So
Reach down to the fork crown.
Yeah.
I've always thought that was mad on a mountain bike. You've got to reach to the fork crown and turn it off.
Yeah, you know? And turn a thing.
Yeah.
So you have to opt up. You're not going to take your hands off the bar on a World Cup downhill track. So although Lloyd Bruni has been on a couple of tracks actually recently. He's been tweaking stuff on his race run, which is really interesting. But if you can't take your hands off the bar, it means you have to optimize your suspension for one particular part of the track. So you can't optimize for the pedally bit or the jumpy bit, or you have to optimize your suspension setup to whichever bit is going to gain you the most speed. Whereas with a suspension system that thinks and can kind of understand things and move those damper settings around, you start to have a system that optimizes the entire track, which is really exciting. I'm a big geek, so I love this stuff. And then that points towards teams employing suspension data guys that analyze data, and they can optimize the settings. Brilliant. I love it.
Well, it gets to the point where that suspension data guy is an AI. So you've got your own AI in the bike.
Pretty much. Yeah, true. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that flight attendant is it's not halfway there. I wouldn't say it's even an eighth of the way there, but it's I'd love to ride it. From what I've heard, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's the one thing that jumped out at me, because obviously there's been stacks of new forks and shocks and such since we spoke, And it'd be great to get any sort of long-term opinions you've got of something we talked about in 2018-19. But I do think the flight attendant, and I'm not just saying that because WatchOp sponsor us and improve on, you know, transparency here. It just does jump out at me as the next thing that everyone's going to have to be doing at some point.
Yeah, I think I think Fox have done it with their live valve stuff with Mondraker and a couple of other manufacturers, but it didn't have this rider-induced data point, this cadence, which is the big thing. It knows when you're on the pedal. It can anticipate when you're going to be on the pedal because it knows when the torque is applied to the crank. I'm sure there's all sorts of other metrics that they can get from that. It probably knows when you're going off a takeoff because the crank's turned backwards, like as the pressure raises on both the front and rear at the same time. So, like, once you know all that stuff, you can start to do things with it, which is what Fox Live didn't have. It was just electronic lockout, essentially. So yeah, it's really interesting. I would like to ride it, and everyone I've spoken to said it turns a 170 mil, 180 mil long travel trail bike into an XC bike, essentially.
Wow.
Which is saying something for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So let's look at a bit of sort of long-term reviews, both in terms of riding, because, you know, you're a racer, and in terms of service life. When we spoke last, we were talking about the DT Swiss F-Series fork, which were really new at the time. Mm. Had quite an interesting dual spring, so air and coil spring. They're different spring rates optimized for different parts of the travel. And one of the things they were really shouting about, and that you'd said you thought was very good, was a damper that virtually didn't need the setup. It was just put the fork on your bike and ride it. So what's the opinion on those, you know, a year or two down the line?
So we had a demo pair in, I think a lot of the guys rode here. Really interesting fork, in that it had a very different way of thinking of things. So the damper was position sensitive rather than speed sensitive. So obviously traditional dampers are high speed, low speed, compression, high speed, low speed, rebound, whereas this was beginning stroke, end stroke specific, basically where you were in the travel rather than how fast the shock or the wheels are moving. So that was kind of interesting. Had an air spring that had a little coil spring at the bottom of it as well. So the first, I think 15, 20 mil was completely undamped. And actually, so those demo pairs we gave to a customer of ours, Dean, who runs an e-bike actually. And he absolutely loves them. They're from riding them myself. I would say your average car park test, they feel very odd.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of like, these feel a bit weird. Get them in a trail though, get up to speed and really push them. They're unbelievable. They just melt into the trail. They never seem phased. They don't bottom out. They don't top out. They don't do anything weird. And that was on the recommended setting as well. I didn't change anything. I just went and rode on them.
Mm.
The only downside for me is that they're not stiff enough. So, and for me, that's such a massive one. Like they've got to be stiff enough to cope. They're great forks, absolutely love the technology in them. But there were, two things letting them down. One, they weren't stiff enough. And two, they didn't do short offset version. So,
yeah, sure.
That writes off 98% of bikes now, unfortunately. They are bringing out a longer travel version with a bigger stanchion, I think. And there's short offset ones, but I think they were quite slow to the short offset game. And I think their mindset was very much in the XC market or trail market for that fork, and there weren't many bikes running short offset for that at the time. So So it's got some pros and cons on that fork for sure. I'd like to see what they come out with next. I'd like to try the long travel, short offset, bigger stanchion one. That'd be an interesting fork for sure.
Yeah, certainly. If they can take what they've done really well and make it relevant to modern geometry and, as you say, stiffen it up, it could be really exciting. Yeah. So before we finish up then, are there any other products that you've been riding for a while that really stand out and why?
We've got riding all sorts at the minute, and I think Fox 38 is one of my new favourite forks. That's amazing. Out of the box, even just the standard performance model, just brilliant. You just smooth the trail out completely because it's so stiff. Just brilliant. Turns in really well. But I'd say the most standout product from probably the last 2 years was probably Push 11.6 coil shock.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a lot of money and it's prohibitive maybe for some people, but it's honestly the best shock I've ever ridden. Unbelievable. So smooth, so controlled, super tunable, and just really, really, really good. Really good. It's a shame that Push don't go racing. They don't, okay. They don't sponsor anyone. They don't, they lean on their engineering prowess to sell products, which is fine. And that's a good way of doing it. But, in my eyes, they could do with actually going racing, and proving that it's really that good.
It's the shop window, isn't it? For cycles, same with road bikes, mountain bikes, it's all the shop window. And there's a couple of lovely, podcasts as well, the inline podcast I've done with Darren Murphy, who's the founder, and I'll put the links on for those as well, the founder of Push. And I've not ridden that rear shock, but just looking at it, it looks seriously space age.
It's very if you look at the technology in terms of at face value, it's pretty simple because it's a single tube sort of low displacement shock, basically. Mm-hmm. Very simple, really, in the way it works. It's just that every detail is perfect. The coating on the anodizing, the alignment of everything, the spherical eyelet bushes, the way the valve actuates, everything is absolutely perfect. There's been no engineering limitations at all, purely because he's got room in the retail price to do that. So you end up with a shock that's really simple, relatively simple to service, that lasts a long time, that gives you the ultimate performance, really. So, I know Darren pretty well, and we talked about things before, and I just wish that they would put it on Richie Rude's bike, sponsor Richie Rude's, get him off Fox, get him on Push, and win some races on it, and kind of prove it. You know what I mean? Amazing shot. And we've got demo shots and bikes with demo shots on if you ever want to ride one.
Cool. So on that note, I'm sure people are chomping in the bit. So where can people find Plush Suspension online, and where can people find Plush Suspension in the flesh?
So there's a couple of places, obviously Instagram, Facebook, just type in Plush Suspension. Plushsuspension.uk is the website. And you can come and actually hang out with us in the barn. We're part of Brink, Brink Cycle Works. We've got our workshop in the back of Brink. So, address is on the website. You can come down and chat with us. You can book a setup. We've got online booking for setups as well. So you can follow us. Follow us on Instagram, follow us on Facebook, or pop in and have a coffee.
Well, that sounds absolutely awesome, Matt. So thanks so much for your insight. No, always fantastic learning, because you managed to explain so many really complex, topics incredibly simply. Some of the more technical stuff, guys, I'll put a link to the previous podcast Matt did with us, and things like twin tube dampers and spring rates, he goes into those in great detail and describes how it works. So Matt's assuming you've heard that. So go back and listen to that as well. But for now, Matt, thanks so much for your time, and we'll catch up soon.
Cheers, Sean.